We now ask our Brother Dan to come forward and to speak to Isaiah 56 to the subject, and house of prayer for all nations. Thanks, Brother Dan.
Helpful words, Brother Philip, and good evening, everyone. Well, Isaiah chapter 56 is a real chapter of contrasts. On the one hand, it's a very positive chapter. It sets before us God's grace and his mercy, extending his salvation to everybody who will accept it. It's very encouraging, and there are some very exciting words we read in verse 1 to verse 8. But on the other hand, to those who will not listen, it's a chapter of warning. There's no hope for those people, as the fierce judgment of God will eventually fall upon them. Now, to begin with, I'd just like to overview the chapter. Just quickly run through each of the verses and try and pick out the sense of them. So, verse 1 begins, "Thus saith Yahweh, keep ye judgment and do justice." It's a verse of appeal. God is pleading with people to do the right thing because his salvation is near and his righteousness to be revealed. There's opportunity now for people to respond, to do the things that please God, but the opportunity will not last forever. It's actually the third appeal in this section. The first was in Isaiah 55 verse 1. We considered this last class. "Ho, everyone that thirsteth, come ye to the waters, and he that hath no money, come ye, buy and eat." A generous invitation to be a part of God's family, just to listen and to hear the words which God has spoken and to take hold of his covenant. The second appeal was there in verse 6 of chapter 55. "Seek ye Yahweh while he may be found." Again, there's this urgency, isn't it? There's only a limited time to respond. But God's grace gives us that time to respond. And in verse 7, it's through his mercy that he will forgive our sins and let us be part of his family. So that's Isaiah 56, verse 1. Verse 2 is encouraging as well. It's all worth it. It's worth seeking for God's judgment and for his righteousness, or justice as the word says. It's all worth it because blessed is the man that doeth this. And it's also extended to everybody. Blessed is the man that doeth this, and the son of Adam, the Hebrew goes. Not many people are discluded from that. Everyone is a son of Adam. This invitation is open to everybody, if only they will do the things in the rest of verse 2. Keep the Sabbath from polluting it. Keep his hand from doing any evil. So it's open to everybody. And as a striking illustration of this point, the universalness, the extensiveness of this appeal, we're given two examples in verse 3 all the way to verse 7. It's of eunuchs, firstly, and also of strangers. Because, you see, under the law, the eunuch was unable to enter into the congregation of Yahweh. They were excluded. And while the stranger was welcome in principle, in general, the stranger was welcome. Many verses in the Old Testament show us this. There are exceptions, of course, like the Ammonite and the Moabite, they could not. And in Ezra and Nehemiah's time, for example, they took care to exclude people from helping in the work. But in general, the stranger was welcome. And yet, even for the stranger, they could only go so far as well. In the New Testament, we have in Herod's temple the court of the Gentiles. That's as close as the stranger could get, the court of the Gentiles. They couldn't enter into God's presence, into his holy place, into the outer court even. That's as far as they could get. But in Isaiah 56, it's different. We're not talking about the law anymore. It's a different order of things, because the eunuch and the stranger are now welcome to have first-class participation in the family of God. Verse 4, "For thus saith Yahweh unto the eunuchs, the ones that keep my Sabbaths and choose the things that please me and take hold of my covenant, even unto them will I give in mine house, and within my walls. They're allowed right inside the temple now, a place and a name better than that of sons. So the eunuch could now approach under this order of things, and also the stranger, verse 6. Also the sons of the stranger that join themselves to Yahweh, to serve him, to love the name of Yahweh, to be his servants, everyone that keepeth the Sabbath from polluting it, and taketh hold of my covenant. This type of stranger, the one with those qualities in verse 7, even them will I bring to my holy mountain and make them joyful in my house of prayer, right inside the house. There's no barriers anymore, no middle wall of partition. These strangers are welcome to be a part of God's family. And in verse 8, the Lord Yahweh, which gathereth the outcasts of Israel, will also gather others. So it's a spirit of all-inclusiveness. God is holding out his mercy and grace. He's extending it for as long as he can, but the opportunity is limited. There will come a time of judgment. In verse 9, the tone of the chapter dramatically changes. Verses 1 to 8 have been so positive, so encouraging. But now in verse 9, the tone changes. Here there's a criticism of Israel's leaders for their attitude, their characteristics. They were not right before God. Listen to the terrible judgment explained in verse 9. All ye beasts of the field, come to devour. Yea, all ye beasts of the forest. It's totally different, isn't it, from the first 8 verses. And it's against the leaders, because in verse 10, it's to the watchmen. And in verse 11, 3 lines down, it's to the shepherds. These were the leaders of Israel. And this is what they were like. I've written down a few words. Incompetent, greedy, unmotivated, insensitive to their people's needs, selfish, unscrupulous. They didn't care to make a dishonest dollar or shekel, whatever it was. They were irresponsible too. Verse 12 portrays this very aptly. Come ye, say they, I will fetch wine, and we will drink ourselves, and we will fill ourselves with strong drink, and tomorrow shall be as this day, and much more abundant. It's hardly credible, hard to believe that the rulers of Israel, and I don't think this includes the king, by the way, I feel that this chapter is set in Hezekiah's day, but somewhere, some people near the top, not the king himself, were carrying on very foolishly, very irresponsibly, and they had a complacent attitude. Well, they would be judged for that. That's why there was limited opportunity, because these people who should have known better, who should have shepherded the people of God and watched for the dangers, guarded them against that, they just didn't do that. They were unqualified for this office, and so God would send his terrible judgments because of that. So that's how the chapter runs in brief. And just as a way of capturing this, I wrote down a verse that occurred to me. See if you think it fits the situation. It goes like this. Yahweh Elohim, merciful and gracious, long-suffering and abundant in goodness and truth, keeping mercy for thousands, not just Israel, thousands, the eunuchs, the strangers, the Gentiles, and Israel, keeping mercy for thousands, forgiving iniquity and transgression and sin, and that will by no means clear the guilty, visiting the iniquity of the fathers upon the children and upon the children's children unto the third and to the fourth generation. There's the goodness and the severity of God. That verse was Exodus 34, verse 6 and 7, by the way. Seems to summarize Isaiah 56 quite well, I think. Now, let's begin at verse 1 again and have a look in closer detail. We all read along with Brother Andrew, and we read this in verse 1. Thus saith Yahweh, keep ye judgment and do justice. It was very easy, wasn't it? We all turned up in our cars. There was no hostility for us to encounter. There was no angry mob waiting for us on the street or on the path. We just walked inside the hall, and it's air conditioned. We have a nice seat to sit on, and we read, do justice, keep judgment. Sounds very easy, doesn't it? But I don't believe it was so easy in Isaiah's day. It was much more difficult than that. For example, verse 9 to 12, which we've considered, there were those leaders. It was difficult to keep judgment or righteousness, justice in those times. It was difficult. For a start, there was the bad example of the leaders. There were no role models to follow. But it's even worse than that. It's not just simply a matter of example, because the wickedness of these leaders had touched many people's lives. Their unrighteousness, their cruelty had been felt by many people in Isaiah 56. What do I mean? Over the page at the end of verse 11, it says these leaders look every one for his gain from his own quarter. His gain is talking about unrighteous gain. And it was from every quarter. They weren't just beginning to do wickedly. They were unscrupulous. They didn't mind breaking a few of the commandments for a quick shekel or something. And they were used to doing this. They took unrighteous gain from every quarter. And that tells me that there were victims where they were getting this unrighteous gain from. People were suffering at their hands. People felt the abuse of position that they were demonstrating. It was hard at this time. That's not all. Look at the next chapter, chapter 57. There was a lot of hostility to the righteous. 57 verse 1. The righteous perisheth, and no man layeth it to heart, and merciful men are taken away, none considering that the righteous is taken away from the evil to come. To do justice and keep judgment was a hard thing. You could end up paying dearly for it. You could even end up paying with your life. It was a bad society. It wasn't easy, was it? By no means. And did you notice at the end of the verse, none considering that the righteous is taken away from the evil to come? There was judgment coming, wasn't there? Judgment was coming. Opportunity was limited. Just look at the backdrop of evil portrayed in this chapter. And it's not just evil, there's a positive side too in this chapter, but much of society, the majority of society, was very bad. Verse 3. This is how they're described. But draw near hither, ye sons of the sorceress, the seed of the adulterer, and the whore. It's a pretty graphic description. Against whom do you sport yourselves? Against whom do you make a wide mouth and draw out the tongue? Are ye not children of transgression? A seed of falsehood, inflaming yourselves with idols under every green tree, slaying the children, can you believe it, in the valleys, under the cliffs of the rocks? So they were very hostile to the true believers. And in Israeli society, in Jewish society, there was cult worship. All was not well. Come back to Isaiah 51. Still in the same area of Isaiah, aren't we? It was not just a simple matter of coming along, keeping judgment, and doing justice. It just wasn't as simple as that. Isaiah 51, verse 7. Hearken unto me, ye that know righteousness, the people in whose heart is my law. again, a positive invitation to join in, to do righteousness. Hearken unto me. And now, the end of that verse. Fear ye not the reproach of men, neither be ye afraid of their revilings. There was reason to fear. There was reason to be afraid. If you did righteousness, people were against that. You could suffer for it. But the encouraging thing about verse 8, for the moth shall eat them up like a garment, and the worm shall eat them like wool, but my righteousness shall be forever, and my salvation from generation to generation. Do those words ring a bell? For my salvation is near to come, and my righteousness to be revealed. Righteousness, salvation. It's there at the end of verse 8. But my righteousness shall be forever, and my salvation from generation to generation. Look at 51 verse 1. Hearken unto me, ye that follow after righteousness, ye that seek Yahweh. Again, verse 5 and 6. My righteousness is near. My salvation is gone forth. It had already gone forth. It wouldn't be long, and all the oppression and everything else would be passed, and God's salvation would arrive. It had already gone forth, so to speak. Just needed to hang on to that, not get caught up in the tide of evil that was prevalent in that day. Mine arms shall judge the people, the Gentiles. The isles shall wait upon me, and on my arm shall they trust. Lift up your eyes to the heavens, and look upon the earth beneath. For the heavens shall vanish away like smoke. The order of things was going to change. And it wasn't just Israel. The Gentiles would be included in this too. It's exactly the same as the thoughts of Isaiah 56, isn't it? So the point is, it wasn't easy to keep judgment and do justice. In fact, I think many people who try to be righteous felt exasperated. They felt despair. How could they carry on? When would the day come when God finally brought his salvation? How they would have longed for that time to come. But Isaiah 56 verse 1 to 8 puts the balance on it, encouraging people to respond. Yes, respond, and blessings will follow. There'll be a wonderful future for you if you just hold on to what you've got and stand up against the evil society. Compare with Isaiah 33, if you please. There was a need to stand up for one's belief in that day. Isaiah 33 verse 15, he that walketh righteously and speaketh uprightly, he that despiseth the gain of oppressions, what a contrast to the leaders, that shaketh his hands from holding of bribes, that stoppeth his ears from hearing of blood and shutteth his eyes from seeing evil, he shall dwell on high, his place of defence shall be the munitions of rocks, bread shall be given him, his waters shall be sure. Encouragement to do the right thing. Now, let's have a few definitions, I think, from Isaiah chapter 56, verse 1. What do some of the terms mean? First of all, we read, thus saith Yahweh, keep ye judgment. The word keep means to hedge about, to guard, protect, attend to preserve. And there really was a great need to do this, to jealously guard the truth, keep it against all the tide of evil that was around them. They needed to jealously preserve the truth. What about this word judgment? Well, it means a verdict, a sentence, or a law. And you are to keep judgment. It's seems to me this is more a matter of principles to keep judgment. and the other word was justice. It's actually the same as righteousness, a little later in the verse. So I feel that this word judgment is more to do with principles, and the other word, justice, is more to do with living the truth. You're to keep judgment and to do justice in Isaiah 56, verse 1. There was a real need to know what was right, but more than that, there was a need to do what was right. God expected that. And there's still the same need for us today. I think the dangers are far more subtle, but we must know God's righteous principles. We must know the truth, what he wants, and also we must do it. Because the age we live in is gradually corrupting the righteous principles and standing against godly living. But we mustn't go along with that. We mustn't be persuaded by the subtle arguments. We must know and do righteousness. By the way, it sounds a bit like Isaiah's saying, do righteousness and that will give you salvation. Is it righteousness by works then? He can't be saying that, of course, can he? He's not saying that righteousness can be achieved by works. Because in just the last chapter, Isaiah 55, verse 7, let the wicked forsake his way and the unrighteous man his thoughts, and let him return unto Yahweh, and he will have mercy upon him, and to our God, for he will abundantly pardon. Everyone, verse 1, everyone needs God's mercy and forgiveness. We can't do it ourselves. That's clear. So what is Isaiah saying in chapter 56, verse 1? We can't achieve righteousness by works, but it should be a characteristic of those who are waiting and looking for salvation. There should be a degree of righteousness about us. We should display that in our character. Now verse 2. Blessed is the man that doeth this. Please do it, in verse 1, God is saying, because there is blessing. It seems hard now, but there will be blessings in the future. Just hang on to what you've got. Do this. Blessed is the man that doeth this, and the son of man that layeth hold of it. Layeth hold is to firmly grasp. What does Rotherham say? Rotherham says, blessed is the man that doeth this, and the son of man that firmly graspeth it. Strong says the word means to fasten upon or to seize. These righteous people, the ones that do justice, they see God's salvation and his righteousness as something precious, something to hold on to through thick and thin, something very precious in their lives that they wouldn't give up for anything else, to lay hold of it. By the way, blessed is the man that doeth this. That's the justice of verse 1. And layeth hold on it is God's righteousness of salvation. It's another way of saying faith and works. Come to Acts chapter 10. Seems to fit Isaiah 56 very, very well. Acts 10, verse 34. Then Peter opened his mouth and said, of a truth, I perceive that God is no respecter of persons. Everyone. Israelite, eunuch, stranger, everyone. God is no respecter of persons. But in every nation, he that feareth him and worketh righteousness is accepted with him. Those people who have faith, who value God's principles, hold on to them, and also worketh righteousness. There's a need not just to believe, but to do the righteous acts that God wishes us to do. In a book I was reading, I read this comment, which I suppose is obvious to a certain extent, but these words doeth and layeth hold on. He comments on them saying, they are imperfects of continuous action, referring not to a moment of decision, not just one moment, but to living perseverance. So in other words, keeps doing, keeps a grip on, things to hang on to throughout life, not just for a fleeting moment, things we must keep on doing continuously throughout our life. We will have times of weaknesses and times of strength, but we need to keep doing these things throughout our life. Now in verse 1 and 2 we come across various hallmarks of these people who are waiting for the salvation of God, waiting for his righteousness. What have we got? First of all, there was the judgment, knowing right, in verse 1. Then there was the doing right, and also it was seen as something to contend for. They had to keep it, preserve it. So it was something to contend for. And also, in verse 2, they layeth hold of it. That demonstrates an unshakable sort of faith. Demonstrates perseverance, determination to do this. These are the qualities of these people. And also, the final two qualities in verse 2, halfway through the verse now, blessed is the man that keepeth the Sabbath from polluting it and keepeth his hand from doing any evil. I might take the time to write this up. We went through it quite quickly then. This won't take a moment. So there were six things that I mentioned. Knowing right, and from verse 1, to keep judgment. Doing right, do justice. Is that big enough? Something to contend for. You have to keep it, hedge it back, preserve. Something to work for, to guard and protect. They have this unshakable faith. Reference stone is good. That little word in verse 2, laid hold of. They wouldn't let go of it for anything. Nothing would stop them just keeping a grip on God's salvation and righteousness. And the last two things, Sabbath keeping, that's a fine one. Are we supposed to keep the Sabbath today? Should we be holding our meetings on Saturday instead of Sunday? Is that what Isaiah 56 is saying? Of course not. And finally, self-restraint. Keeping his hand from doing any evil. That would have been a very difficult thing, wouldn't it? Imagine if you were a victim of these leaders, their unrighteous gain. By force and brutality, they beat you maybe and stole your money. It would be difficult not to respond in kind, wouldn't it? But you weren't to do that. If you were one of these righteous people, you weren't to do that. You were to keep your hand from doing any evil, not to be caught up in the society, the things that other people were doing. None of these things really come naturally, do they? 55 verse 8, for my thoughts are not your thoughts, neither are your ways my ways, saith Yahweh. For as the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts than your thoughts. For the natural man, it's not easy to do those things. It takes work, it takes effort, but we're expected to do them if we're to attain God's blessings. I feel that all of these are self-evident, apart from this one. We need to define this Sabbath-keeping idea a little bit more closely. What was the point of the Sabbath? I'll read you a quote, because in ancient days, it was unusual to stop work on a Saturday, or on any day for that matter. It wasn't the done thing amongst most of the nations. Listen to this quote. Persians, Babylonians, Canaanites, Egyptians, Greeks, none of these ever thought of stopping work one day in seven, so as to give ordinary people a complete day of rest. They didn't even think of doing that. Israel was unique in the respect of keeping the Sabbath. Keeping God's Sabbath, he goes on, meant, moreover, that those same common folk might be taught to possess a God-centered theology. What was the point of the Sabbath? What was the point of just stopping work? Was it just to do nothing? Well, this quote has highlighted one important aspect, and it was to stop. And apart from life, you know, the things you need to do in life, getting food and clothing, it recognizes that you needed to do them 6 days of the week. But on the seventh day, you're to stop and reorganize life around the Sabbath. God was to be at the center of the week, if you like, a positive reordering of life around God. That's basically what the Sabbath was. Now, how did people keep the Sabbath in Isaiah's time? What was their attitude to the Sabbath? Come to Isaiah chapter 1, please. Because the Sabbath was kept and viewed in the wrong sort of way. It was almost like a nuisance to people, this stopping work. Couldn't wait. Greg's waving to me because I've forgotten to put this on. Is that right? No, we've only been going half an hour, Greg. You'll feel one side of the tape. Or I can go on till 10 o'clock if you like. Right. Where were we? Isaiah chapter 1, and we're considering what the Sabbath was like in those days. How did people view the Sabbath? Isaiah chapter 1, verse 13. Bring no more vain oblations, God says. Incense, the incense that was offered in the altar, was an abomination unto me. The new moons, the feast that was held every month, the new moons and Sabbaths, the calling of assemblies, I cannot. Away with it. It is iniquity, even the solemn meetings. Your new moons and your appointed feasts my soul hateth. All these feasts, including the Sabbath, by the way, all these things God abhorred. They were not kept in the right spirit. People had missed the point of what they were supposed to see from these things. Here's another interesting quotation in Amos chapter 8. Amos was contemporary with Isaiah. Isaiah ministered during the reign of four kings: Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, Hezekiah. Amos ministered during the reign of Uzziah only. So he was contemporary with Isaiah for the first part of Isaiah's ministry. And in Amos chapter 8, Amos comments on the people's attitude to the Sabbath. Amos 8 verse 4. Hear this, O ye that swallow up the needy, even to make the poor of the land to fail, saying, when will the new moon be gone, that we may sell corn, and the Sabbath, that we may set forth wheat, making the ephah small and the shekel great, and falsifying the balances by deceit. What a nuisance the Sabbath was to them. When will it be over? They were so weary with the Sabbath, just sitting around doing nothing. When will the Sabbath be over and we can get back to all our unrighteous ways, tricking people, making the ephah small, and deceiving people by falsifying the balances, that we may buy the poor for silver and the needy for a pair of shoes, yea, and sell the refuse of the wheat? Yahweh hath sworn by the excellency of Jacob, surely I will never forget any of their works. They'd lost the spirit of the Sabbath, hadn't they? It was just a ritual. They'd lost the spirit of it altogether. Isaiah 58, please. Isaiah chapter 58 begins like this. Cry aloud, spare not, lift up thy voice like a trumpet, and show my people their transgression, and the house of Jacob their sins. So there was sin and transgression evident in the people of God at this time. But verse 2, everything on the appearance, everything seemed to be working well, operating just fine. But it wasn't just the appearance, it was what went on underneath, in people's minds. Verse 2, yet they seek me daily and delight to know my ways, as a nation that did righteousness and forsook not the ordinance of their God. They ask of me the ordinances of justice. They take delight in approaching to God. It seemed just fine, didn't it? But verse 3, wherefore have we fasted, say they, and thou seest not? God didn't take delight in this type of attitude. Wherefore have we afflicted our soul, and thou takest no knowledge? All their religion was worthless. God didn't pay any notice to it, didn't pay any attention. Behold, in the day of your fast you find pleasure and exact all your labours. Here was the proper spirit of it in verse 13. They had the wrong spirit, of course, but in verse 13, this is what God wanted to see from people who kept the Sabbath. If thou turn away thy foot from the Sabbath, from doing thy pleasure on my holy day, and call the Sabbath a delight, the holy of Yahweh, honourable, and shalt honour him, not doing thine own ways, nor finding thine own pleasure, nor speaking thine own words, then shalt thou delight thyself in Yahweh, and I will cause thee to ride upon the high places of the earth, and feed thee with the heritage of Jacob, thy father, for the mouth of Yahweh has spoken it. So the Sabbath wasn't just for sitting there and doing no work, thinking, how can I define what is work and what isn't work? Because that's what the Jews did. If you could tie a knot with one hand, that was fine. But if the knot took two hands to tie, that knot couldn't be done on the Sabbath. That was work. But with one hand, it wasn't work. So they had all these rules and regulations about the Sabbath, what one could and couldn't do, and spent hours and volumes of books writing down these laws. But that just wasn't the point of the Sabbath. The point of the Sabbath was to just sit and reflect on God, not to do your own works, to cease from that for a day, and to think about what God has done. Think about how to please him. That was what the Sabbath was really about. And in that sense, we can keep the Sabbath today. One more thing about the Sabbath. Oh, we won't turn up the quote in view of time. But the Sabbath pointed towards the millennium, pointed towards God's kingdom. It spoke of a rest to come, the seventh day. And the quote is Hebrews chapter 4 verse 4 and also verse 9 to 11 if you want. Now I said verse 2, the appeal of verse 2 extended to everyone. Blessed is the man that doeth this, and the son of man that layeth hold upon it. The first man, the man, is in the Hebrew Enosh, a weak mortal man. And that's everybody, isn't it? And the second word is son of man in our authorized version, but in the Hebrew it is Ben Adam, one who shares in the common humanity of all. So it really is talking about everyone, isn't it? And the first word, Enosh, weak mortal man, shows that we're unable to save ourselves. We have to rely upon God, just like Isaiah 55 verse 7. And everyone needs it. Son of Adam. We all have a common need for salvation. And that's just like Isaiah 55 verse 1. Ho, everyone that thirsteth. Isaiah 56 verse 1 to 8 has a lot to say on this theme of the all-inclusiveness of God's plan, the inclusion of everybody. Take for example verse 3, there's the stranger and the eunuch, they're included. Verse 7, the end of verse 7, mine house shall be called an house of prayer for all people. And verse 8, the Lord Yahweh which gathereth the outcasts of Israel saith, yet will I gather others to him besides those that are gathered unto him. So it was to include others, the Gentiles. Now verse 3, I think I'm going to have to speed up rather a lot. We have actually outlined verse 3, that the stranger and the eunuch couldn't come into the temple. There was a sort of second-classness about the stranger and the eunuch. They were invited to be part of God's family, but at a distance as well. They couldn't come right to the heart of worship in Israel under the law. It's interesting, isn't it, that the two things that are chosen are the stranger and the eunuch. The stranger had no history, no past amongst the people of God. Typically, they had left their father and mother, their land, and they had come to Israel. They were the first generation, so to speak. Contrast that with the eunuch, who may well have been born into a family in Israel. And yet they had no future. So one had no past, the other had no future. There was no chance that they would bear sons and daughters. After their death, it was the end. So one had no past, the other had no future. Now, why was it that the eunuch, for example, wasn't allowed to approach before God? Is my pronunciation of eunuch rather amusing? No? Why was it that the eunuch couldn't come close to God? Did God not really care about these people? Other examples, why was it that someone who was a dwarf couldn't be a priest? Or someone with a crooked back? Or someone who was lame or blind? Why couldn't they be a priest? Did God hate these people? Could they not be a part of his salvation? Of course not. The idea was to teach people, not about physical imperfections, it was about moral imperfections. Only people who are morally perfect could approach to God. Clearly God's view hadn't changed by Isaiah 56 verse 3. He wasn't saying, oh, I've changed my mind, now all these people can be included. He wasn't changing his mind at all. It was God's way all along. The law was given to teach people about the approach to God. And also, underlining the law was the fact that the law couldn't save. And it needed to teach that too. So that's why I feel that the eunuch was excluded. The stranger was always welcome. I'll read some quotes for you. Blessings to Abraham. And I'll bless them that bless thee, and curse him that curseth thee, and in thee shall all families of the earth be blessed. It wasn't just to Israel. Right from the start, it wasn't just Israel that was to be included. Genesis 17, Abraham is told, for a father of many nations have I made thee. Come to this one, Exodus chapter 12. Exodus chapter 12 and verse 48. It's about keeping the Passover. But it wasn't just Jews who could keep the Passover. 48 says, and when a stranger shall sojourn with thee and will keep the Passover to Yahweh, let all his males be circumcised, and then let him come near and keep it. And he shall be as one that is born in the land, for no uncircumcised person shall eat thereof. So if the stranger was circumcised, then they were welcome, most welcome to keep the Passover. God would include them. A striking example of a stranger who was accepted was the woman Ruth, and she was a Moabite. Moabites weren't allowed to enter the congregation of God. And yet Ruth was allowed. She ended up being in the line of Christ, so a very special woman. And yet even Ruth had a stigma attached to her. Boaz was eager to marry her, but there was the near kinsman who had to be approached first, and he was quite keen on receiving the land that came with the inheritance. He was quite keen when he knew the deal extended as far as that. But as soon as he heard that he had to take Ruth to be his wife as well, he had none of it. That was it. The deal was off. Because she was a Moabite, and because strangers had this stigma attached to them. So in Isaiah 56, verse 3, God's principle was that everyone, everybody, Israelite, stranger, eunuch, every one of those could come near to God if they responded in the right way. That was God's way. But they could feel very distant in society. In Jewish society, they could feel very distant, even though that wasn't God's intention. Neither let the son of the stranger that hath joined himself to Yahweh speak, saying, Yahweh hath utterly separated me from his people. I'm just not one of his people. I'm on the perimeter. I'm not part of God's family, not at the heart of it. Neither let the eunuch say, behold, I am a dry tree. I think there's a lesson for us here as an ecclesia. I think we've got to be very sensitive towards people. There are people who can feel lonely in ecclesial life, and even though that's not our intention, people can still feel like that. People who are new to the ecclesia, perhaps, can feel they haven't got any friends. They don't know anyone at this new ecclesia. By the way, I'm not grinding an axe here, because I felt very welcome. So thank you, everyone, for making me feel so welcome. But it's true, some people can feel very lonely and isolated in an ecclesia. Just not confident, perhaps. And also there are the eunuchs, aren't there? People who don't have a family, perhaps don't have a husband or a wife. And they come to the ecclesia and they see all the other families. We must take care and be sensitive of their feelings. Include them in our family life. Think of them. And also there are the strangers who come to our halls, the interested friends. We must try to include them too. Show them warmth. Show them that there's something worth coming to. I feel that that's a lesson that we can learn. And I'm not saying that this ecclesia is particularly bad at that. I'm just making the point from verse 3. Perhaps we really will go to 10 o'clock, Greg. No, we won't. We'll stop before then. Let's do this very quickly. Yes, verse 4 to 7. The eunuchs and the strangers. What a contrast these people are. People who weren't nigh unto God because of the law, and yet look at their attitude. Take the eunuchs in verse 4 firstly. For thus saith Yahweh unto the eunuchs that keep my Sabbaths, and choose the things that please me, and take hold of my covenant. They're God-centered, aren't they? Their focus is on God, and their reward corresponds to that. Verse 5, even unto them will I give in mine house, and within my walls, a place and a name better than that of sons. Verse 6, this is now the attitude of the stranger. Again, God-centered. Also, the sons of the stranger. This is a Gentile, or many Gentiles, unfamiliar with God, and yet somehow have come to learn about him. Look at their attitude, verse 6. Also, the sons of the stranger that join themselves to Yahweh, to serve him, and to love the name of Yahweh, to be his servants. everyone that keepeth the Sabbath from polluting it, and taketh hold of my covenant. Again, they're very God-centered, aren't they? That's what they care about. That's the centre of their lives. And their reward corresponds. Even them, verse 7, will I bring to my holy mountain and make them joyful in my house of prayer. Their burnt offerings and their sacrifices shall be accepted upon mine altar, for mine house shall be called an house of prayer for all people. Many, many times. How many times was it? Perhaps 12 times we read the words my, me, mine, his, etc. Centered upon God. Now look at the contrast. Verse 11. This is the leaders, the watchmen, the shepherds. Where's their focus? Yea, verse 11, they are greedy dogs which can never have enough, and they are shepherds that cannot understand. They all look to their own way. Everyone for his gain from his quarter. Come ye, say they, I will fetch wine and we will fill ourselves. They weren't very outward looking, were they? Concerned about themselves. Apart from verse 12, that this is how far their outreach went. Come ye, say they, I will fetch wine and we will fill ourselves. Oh, they were very kind and considerate to their cronies. They included their buddies in their drunken feasts. But the point is, they were centred upon themselves, and they should have known better. They were the leaders. What a shame on them that others, the unprivileged, such as the eunuch and the stranger, had the focus, the perspective right in life. Now, time to cut and paste. We come now to verse 9. After remarking that verse 7 is quoted in the New Testament 3 times, we come to verse 9, and the tone changes dramatically. 2 quotes from the same author. Verse 9, the tone has changed so much, and we can't see it, but the actual Hebrew, the way the literature is written, has changed as well. Listen to this. The first quote. Savagery of imagery and of style reflects the prophet's loathing of a major factor in the loss of the ideal. Leaders who are blind and self-seeking. So, just the way the words are written is savage in style and imagery. I suppose verse 9, we can see it a little bit. All ye beasts of the field come to devour. Wild animals descend and devour, just tear flesh. And the second quote, nothing can recapture the taut anger of the Hebrew, but even in translation, the biting irony of the bracketing verses, verse 9 and 12, is unmistakable. What does that mean? So obviously, the literature is full of taut anger. We can't see that, unfortunately. We'll just have to believe it. But we can see this. There's biting irony in this section in verse 9 to 12, where the attitude of these leaders is described. What's the irony? We've gone through all their characteristics, but the section opens in verse 9 with a feast. All ye beasts of the field, come to devour, yea, all ye beasts of the forest. Guests are bidden to a feast in verse 9, the opening verse. And in the closing verse, 12, there is a feast again. Both of them contain the word come, an invitation to this feast. Come ye, say they, I will fetch wine, and we will fill ourselves with strong drink, and tomorrow shall be as this day, and much more abundant. So here are these leaders, and the shepherds and watchmen of Israel, living it up, having a wonderful time, or so they think, just dropping all responsibility and sinking into intoxication. trying to enjoy themselves like that, feasting and carrying on like there's no tomorrow. And while they're having that feast, this is the ironic thing, while they're carrying on like that in their feast, they don't know it, but in verse 9, God's already arranged another feast, and they're the meal. It's tragic, absolutely tragic. It's a really short section, but goes straight for the jugular. Isaiah does not mince his words at all. Let me just find something in my notes. I'd like to just jot down the characteristics of these people. Verse 10. His watchmen are blind, they are all ignorant, they are all dumb dogs, they cannot bark. So here's my first word. I've just put one word, incompetent, against that. They weren't qualified for what they were doing. Blind watchmen, ever heard of that? They're ignorant. They just don't know. They're all dumb dogs. They can't bark. What's the point of that? That will give no warning to people. So that's the first characteristic, incompetence. Second one is the end of verse 10. Sleeping, lying down, loving to slumber. They were unmotivated. Should have been an example, but they just did nothing with their time. Contrast, for example, to verse 4. The eunuchs that choose the things that please me. That's what they chose. But these people just lazed around all day. They were unmotivated. Verse 11. Yea, they are greedy dogs which can never have enough. They were greedy, and they are shepherds that cannot understand, do not know discernment, is what one translation put it like. They were shepherds, but they just couldn't discern. They were supposed to be shepherds and care for their flock. This sheep is old, perhaps, and can't keep up. Can't keep up if we set the pace too high. Knowing the characteristics of the sheep, or this sheep over here is having a calf, I was about to say, but sheep don't have that. But having a lamb. Just knowing the characteristics of all of these sheep. Or perhaps this is a young one which has only been born and needs care and sensitivity, special attention to start with, just to set it on life's way. But they weren't that sort of shepherd. They just didn't understand. They didn't care about their flock. So I put insensitive against that. A really interesting quote, John chapter 10. Well, I think it's interesting. I hope you do too. John chapter 10. John chapter 10 is about the true shepherd, Jesus Christ. John 10 verse 16. Verse 14. I, says Jesus, am the good shepherd and know my sheep and am known of mine. As the Father knoweth me, even so know I the Father, and I lay down my life for the sheep. What a shepherd is he! Lays down his life for the sheep. And other sheep have I which are not of this fold. That was just like Isaiah 56 verse 8. I can't remember it exactly, but it went something like this. The Lord Yahweh, which gathereth the outcasts of Israel, will gather the outcasts of other nations. Something along those lines. So verse 16, another sheep have I which are not of this fold. Them also I must bring, and they shall hear my voice. And there shall be one fold and one shepherd. So there's the good shepherd, but contrast him with the others. Like we've read of in Isaiah 56, verse 9 to 12. Look at verse 12. But he that is an hireling, and not the shepherd, just a hireling, whose own the sheep are not, seeth the wolf coming, and leaveth the sheep, and fleeth. And the wolf catcheth them, and scattereth the sheep. The hireling fleeth, because he is an hireling, and careth not for the sheep. That's just like the attitude of these people, isn't it? insensitive, uncaring. The next thing, in verse 11 of Isaiah 56, shepherds that cannot understand, they all look to their own way. Very selfish people. And the next thing, everyone for his unrighteous gain from his quarter. I jotted down a translation of what that is. Yes, this I suggest is probably a better translation. Each utterly seeks his own gain, own unrighteous gain. That's for the whole of the verse. Anyway, the word I've put against that, they were unscrupulous. They would do anything just to feather their own nest. They'd go to any lengths. Didn't trouble their conscience if someone had to pay the price. As long as it benefited them, they didn't care. They would do unrighteous gain time and time again, anywhere. So they were unscrupulous. They were also, verse 12, irresponsible. They spent the whole day in drunken feasts, reveling with their friends, consuming vast quantities of alcohol. Just irresponsible. And these were the leaders. How could you lead if you spent the day like that? And finally, to put the cap on it, they say, and tomorrow shall be as this day, and much more abundant. Didn't really care about tomorrow. As far as they were concerned, tomorrow would be better. Just the same, maybe, as today. No worries. No worries, mate. They were complacent about life. Now, I'll read a quote to you. It's from 2 Peter. 2 Peter chapter 3. Where is it? Verse 4. Knowing this verse, that there shall come in the last days scoffers walking after their own lusts. Now this is the verse. And saying, where is the promise of his coming? For since the fathers fell asleep, all things continue as they were from the beginning of creation. It's the same attitude. 2 Peter 3 verse 4 that was. Now I want you to turn to 1 Thessalonians chapter 5. This is the lesson that I think we can draw from those leaders. This is where we can take heed in our own lives. First of Thessalonians chapter 5. Starting at verse 4. But ye, brethren, are not in darkness, that the day should overtake you as a thief. Ye are all the children of light, and the children of the day. We're not of the night, nor of darkness. Therefore, let us not sleep as do others. Remember they lay around all day in Isaiah 56? Let us not sleep as do others, but let us watch and be sober. They were supposed to be watchmen, but weren't. Let us watch. Let us discern the signs of the times and care for other people. For they that sleep, sleep in the night, and they that be drunken. Another link of language. They that be drunken are drunken in the night. But let us who are of the day be sober, putting on the breastplate of faith and love, and for an helmet the hope of salvation. That's what Isaiah 56 was all about. People who are waiting for God's salvation. So let us wait and be sober. Now I have much to say about the Ethiopian eunuch, but we won't, Greg. Maybe we can leave that for the discussion period. How can we close? Let's come back to Isaiah 56. The Ethiopian eunuch is intensely interesting, I think, because he was both a stranger and a eunuch, an Ethiopian eunuch. And it's very special to me because my parents are in Ethiopia at the moment. Isaiah 56 verse 1. Let's just summarise this chapter. What are the lessons for us? Thus saith Yahweh, keep judgment, do justice, for my salvation is near to come and my righteousness to be revealed. Our salvation is so near, isn't it? We are seeing signs more and more frequently. More and more often, Jerusalem is in the news. It can't be long. We just need to wait and hang on to what we've got. We need to keep his Sabbaths, so to speak. We need to choose the things that please him. Take hold of his covenant. We need to join ourselves to God in devotion. We'll continue to do so. To love him, to serve him. And those type of people, verse 7, if we're like that, even them will I bring to my holy mountain and make them joyful in my house of prayer. Their burnt offerings and their sacrifices shall be accepted. We will have acceptance and fellowship with the God of all the earth. Mine house shall be called an house of prayer for all people.